Hello, you're listening to a Melbourne Writers Festival podcast recorded at MWF Digital in 2020.
Hi, my name's Cynthia Cunningham and I'm here to talk to Michael Christie, the author of Greenwood, which is a really extraordinary novel. It's about trees. I love trees. That's why I am talking to Michael today. And before I introduce Michael, I'm going to do what I see other people do on stage if they're meeting a person, that is, show him the gift I would have given him if we're on stage together. I saw this done actually with Richard Powers. I made a sculpture yesterday from a cracked recorder. It's rosewood, because I share, I work in a convent with old instruments, and I put a Banksia on top. So the Banksia would have been yours if we were meeting in person, because I know you like wood. That's the idea.
I do. Wow. We'll have to get a rain check on that. That is gorgeous. Thank you. That's very thoughtful.
Because you did indeed used to be a carpenter, am I right?
I have been a carpenter, yes. I built the house that I live in currently. So yeah. I'm a bit of an amateur. I'm certainly not going to claim any kind of great work. I do a kind of a rough and ready style of carpentry that is very cost effective.
Okay, well, as well as being an amateur carpenter, even though that's more than most people I know have ever done, you're the author of the novel If I Fall, If I Die, which was long-listed for several prizes and numerous lists in 2015, which is when it came out. You've got a collection, The Biggest Garden, also honoured in many ways, and you've written for the New York Times, Washington Post, The Globe and The Mail, and Greenwood came out, am I right, in January this year?
It did. It came out in Canada in the fall in September and then in Australia in January.
So it's had an exciting birth, this novel. There's several authors I've interviewed this year have written books that in some way touch upon what our possible futures might be. And you and all of you have ended up in this situation of not promoting your book in the way that you might have expected. And I'm not going to dwell at all on the pandemic because there's no point, but I did want you to just briefly tell the audience what it's meant for you to try and talk about your work in 2020, basically.
Yeah, I mean, when the book came out in Australia, that was just after the bushfires had happened, or were still going, but had sort of run their course almost. And I thought that was going to be the really, tragic event that my book would be sort of associated with, unfortunately, and, fortunately in a way, and that it's in people's minds. But I had no idea that, the pandemic would be hot on its heels on a disaster like that. So yeah, it's been a struggle. I've canceled probably about 35 tour dates related to the pandemic, but I mean, I'm certainly not going to complain.
You've traveled on ships, you told us, to avoid planes.
I did.
In your race home after Adelaide.
That's right. After Adelaide, I was in the US on a little US tour on the West Coast, just as things were heating up there. And I ended up in Seattle doing an event with me and, one person at an indie bookstore who was basically wearing a hazmat suit. And I said, thanks for coming. And then got on a ship to come home from Seattle to Vancouver, just so I could be outside and not have to be on an airplane, which is obviously turning out to be one of the more dangerous things you can do. So yeah, but I do think people have been reading a whole lot with all this spare time that they have and all this quarantining. And then I think that's an encouraging thing to take from all this.
In Australia, I think fiction sales have gone up. Non-fiction, not so much. But, I hope that certainly I know a lot of people are reading Greenwood. And actually, you talked about getting home to your island off Vancouver. That's relevant in a way to the novel because it's so can you tell us a little bit about where you live? I'm not going to dwell on your real life, but I do think it's kind of relevant here.
It's okay. I'm a writer whose real life is quite entwined with my fiction, so I'm happy to discuss it. But I live on a small forested island just off the coast of Vancouver called Galliano Island. really tall Douglas firs, Western red cedars, very, you know, wooded, thickly wooded place. And I live in actually in a house that I, as I mentioned earlier, that I built of the trees that we brought down to clear the land where we live. So it's a place that is very much enmeshed, a life that is very much enmeshed with the forest. And so that a lot of my experiences living here went into the writing of Greenwood.
One of the something you say to in if I can quote you at yourself, you say in Greenwood, wood is time captured and cellular memory, a record. This is why Liam believes carpenters like himself will never go out of business, because people will always keep wood close in our houses and on our floors, ceilings and walls, in our trusted canes and our finest musical instruments, in our heirloom tables and our old rocking chairs, and most tellingly in the very capsules that ease our journey into the ground. That's a scene I think he's been involved in making a coffin with his uncle, possibly, just around that time. But
that's correct. Yeah, he's remembering making a coffin for his great uncle, or his sort of beloved great uncle, yeah.
Because one of the things that that really comes through in the book is you don't just write about trees, you write about wood. I mean, wood, and I wanted you to, like, are you interested in wood and woodwork? Is it trees? I also understand these things have metaphoric qualities, but I'm kind of curious to know what came, whether you look at a tree and see a house, or do you look at a tree and see nature?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things I love about fiction, particularly literary fiction, it can provide multiple points of view at the same time without really signing off on any one of them. So the Greenwood family, which this novel tells the story of five generations of the Greenwood family, and each generation through history has a close yet very different relationship with forests, wood, and trees. And so the very first generation in the family, they are two brothers, and they live as woodcutters selling firewood to the local people, and sort of live a very subsistence style of lifestyle. And the next generation, there is a timber tycoon who goes and cuts down enormous acres and acres of old growth timber in Canada and partly in the United States, sort of amassing a great fortune. His daughter, of course, is a environmental activist who's sort of trying to right the wrongs of her father. Her son is a carpenter for very wealthy people who does, you know, reclaimed wood installations in the homes of the very rich. And finally, his daughter, his estranged daughter, is a scientist who studies the intercommunicative properties of various tree species. So that's a long answer to say, yes, I like to think, you know, about wood and trees are such a beloved thing to us. I'm just reading a new version of the Brothers Grimm fairy tales done by the Philip Pullman, who wrote The Golden Compass. And he went in and went to the original source material of these, you know, oral folk tales that the Brothers Grimm heard from, you know, German peasants, and kind of narratively tweaked them and rewrote them and put some modern dialogue. And they're just a delight. It's a delightful book. But to see how many woodcutters, how many forests that children disappear into, how many, you know, trees that have magical properties in just those stories alone, I really think speaks to the penetration and the sort of great relationship that the human being has with trees and with wood. And I feel that same relationship myself. I, you know, some of my most treasured things are made of wood, most of them. And I think just the fact that wood has been alive, and just its sort of similarity to human flesh, I think is very profound for us.
There's a tree we have in Australia, well, we know it colloquially as the lemon-scented gum, but it's a
yep.
And that has, at certain times of the year, it does actually look like human skin. It's really quite, it's got sort of like little folds of flesh around it, around what looks like knees. And it's pretty amazing how human kind of they can appear.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, nobody, you know, there, and if you look in, of course, cultures across the world, not just German or Western culture, indigenous cultures obviously have scores of legends and stories about trees, and those go back millennia. So yeah, I think that there's just something about trees that connects to us. And of course, you in your wonderful book have talked about this as well. So, I mean, I didn't make this up, but I was very happy to write a book that tried to get some of that relationship across and portray a one family's relationship with wood and with trees over, you know, 130 years.
And the such complex relationships. So the book does cover, it does what you've just discussed, really. It gives you lots of, the intergenerational structure allows you to see lots of different subjects from different points of view, which is, so it's almost, it's kaleidoscopic in some way. So you're interested in issues around trees, we've talked about that, nature of family, community, addiction, poverty, class. Can you pinpoint which, if any of these came first? I mean, there is so much in this book. I was kind of curious to know what its genesis was.
I'm a very kind of messy writer in the sense that I generate a lot of ideas. I generate a lot of characters just sort of intuitively. And then I sort of look for ways that those characters can exist together. And that was sort of what happened. But the very first seed of the story was an idea I had of a character who's kind of a hermit, who's living sort of hidden in the woods, finds a baby in the forest. And this is, you know, sort of the seed of one of the seeds that plants, you know, the Greenwood family tree. And it's interesting the way that I say it now. It sounds very fairy tale like. It's sort of like the woodcutter refusing to kill the child. Is it Snow White? Is that Snow White? Yeah, I think it is. The woodcutter is supposed to take the baby into the woods and kill her, but he refuses to and lets her go, and she goes to live with the dwarves. So there's a kind of a fairy tale quality to that story, a sort of a mythic quality. But that was the very first idea I had. But you know, it expanded, you know, during 5 years of writing and 5 years of research and work on the book to a lot more than that.
It sort of expanded around that, didn't it? That moment is quite deep in the center of the book. Is that right?
It is. Yeah.
Because the structure is something I.
Yeah, it happens. We haven't mentioned the structure yet, but it.
Can you talk about the structure?
Sure. Yeah, the book itself is structured like the rings of a tree. So the narrative begins in the future, 2038, just the near future. And then as you read, it progresses back to 2008. And each generation, it steps back some years, and then it goes to 1974, and then it goes to 1934, and then 1908. And then once you reach the middle of the book, which is called the Heartwood, you begin to come back out and step out through time again to the future. So it's sort of told in nested rings of narrative with the intent of sort of mimicking the actual physical structure of a tree where I live. But I understand that trees in the Southern Hemisphere don't build growth rings in this way necessarily.
They're droughts, they don't. Yeah.
Right. That was the way that I found that was the way to tell the story, and that was the sort of structure that I arrived upon. And it was very fun, it's a sort of a fun challenge to try to write a book that would tell the story in such a unusual way, but yet have that structure really add to the suspense, not only the suspense, but the sort of sense of traveling back in time with the story as a reader and then coming back out.
And when did that structure come to you, after you talked about that slightly chaotic, which is very familiar to me, of coming up with characters and ideas and sort of trying to work out how they fit together? When did the structure help you pull all that together? How far into that 5-year process?
Yeah, it came to me when I cut down a tree. It sounds very sort of easy, almost pat, but I was cutting down a small tree to make way for our driveway, and hadn't really cut many trees down before. And I did some Googling, YouTubing, watching people how they, did the cross cut and the back cut and what to do. I borrowed a chainsaw. I didn't have one at the time. And so I cut down this tree and I saw the stump there, and right away sap, it was a Douglas fir, and sap started sort of oozing out almost like blood. And I saw the tree rings and I thought, wow, this tree's story is right there. This thing. And I counted the rings, and it was older than I was at the time, and thought, what an amazing way that would be to tell a story of a family, to move through the rings like that and to sort of use that structure as a narrative structure for a book. And so once I had that, then all the characters who were floating around in my head began to become organized and come together. And I realized they were all members of the same family.
The reason why I'm going to stop talking about this, because it's sort of nerdy and more about my interests than necessarily the audience's, but I do love the way structure can result. You can be really messy with a project and it can take years, and then suddenly you do have a moment that feels quite simple, where it sort of everything starts to reorganize itself around that moment. And so I envy you that tree cutting moment.
It was a good day. They're not, not all days at the writing desk are good days, but it was a great relief to find that that structure and that, it solved a lot of problems.
So early on, we talked a little bit about Vancouver Island, but can you talk a little bit about how personal experiences inform characterisation? So, for example, you've worked in shelters with homeless people, and there's certainly long sequences with a character called Emmett, one of the main characters, who's a tramp. I don't know if that word's an acceptable word, but for a period of time. And Lomax, Lomax, who's also sort of pursuing him through, Depression era kind of towns. And not just that experience, but I'm just curious to know how kind of real life experiences transform into fiction, because certainly I didn't read this and think, I'm reading about this person, which is about the voice. It's not really, I would know what your personal experiences are, but it doesn't read as if it's your personal experience, but clearly it informs the work.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in, a writer having some kind of investment in each character that they write. And, that doesn't necessarily sharing a background or sharing immediate experiences, but there needs to be some sort of skin in the game or some sort of emotional resonance for the writer themselves to really connect with that character. That's just something that I believe. And so I do feel a real connection with many, many of the characters, and pretty much all of the major characters in this novel. And yes, my time, I was working at a homeless shelter in probably it is the poorest and most drug afflicted neighborhood in Canada. It's called the downtown east side of Vancouver. It's sort of the famous for that. And, I worked there for a number of years in an emergency homeless shelter that was specifically geared towards people who have severe mental health issues coupled with substance use issues. And I must say that at that time, I was a younger man and I was not that far out from staying there while I was working there. I mean, I was enduring a lot of stress, a lot of trauma, and I was dealing with that in ways that were not necessarily healthy at the time. And so, but working in a homeless shelter is a fascinating study in human nature, because you see people at their most stripped down. You see people who are living day to day and are grinding through lives that you can't even imagine, and who are resilient in the face of traumas that, you know, are almost impossible to imagine ever getting beyond. And so for me, that really focused my own creative vision around the kind of people that I'd like to portray and the sort of struggles that I'd like to portray in my fiction. I'm never going to write about a suburban person worrying if the neighbors think their lawn is nice. You know, like it's just, like, and those books are great, but I am always, I think, going to write about, you know, real life and death struggles, hunger, poverty, those types of things just interest me. And I, you know, that I don't think I would write in that way unless I'd worked there where I did, because it was an eye-opening experience.
As you were talking, it actually brought me to a present day question. I just wondered what the situation is like at the moment. Is the pandemic increasing the homeless situation in that? Because I have heard about that part of Vancouver.
Yes.
But I don't really know what's happening in Canada at the moment.
I mean, to their great credit, there were housing initiatives and addictions initiatives that, you know, we were fighting for years in those neighborhoods. And then as soon as the pandemic hit, both in Vancouver and Victoria, which is another place I spend some time now, the government were like, let's just buy some hotels and house people, because they were so concerned with the sizable homeless population catching the pandemic and then spreading it to everyone else, right? And so it's good that they ended up doing, you know, footing the bill and getting people housing and getting people off the street, but the motivation for it wasn't quite as altruistic as I would have hoped. Thankfully, the pandemic is not ripping through the homeless community, which is very, very encouraging, because those people are obviously much more vulnerable than anyone to its negative effects.
And is Canada, because you're you share a border with the country that I think has the worst numbers for the pandemic in the world. Well, I could be wrong about that. India, anyway, it's not good.
You're probably
what's the situation where you're living?
I mean, we're close to the U.S. border here on Galliano. We have a lot of boats still coming up from the U.S., even though there are strict travel restrictions. I have a number of friends who live in the U.S., and, you know, they're horrified at the callousness and the sort of just laissez-faire approach that the administration is taking to the pandemic. And it's sad and it's tragic and it's only getting worse, it seems. So Canadians are very concerned with keeping that border. Someone was joking that Trump wanted to build a wall with Mexico, but now we
share. You want to build one with you on the side.
That's right. Or someone, one of my friends who's very funny, suggested a hedge, maybe a nice hedge, you know, that we could just deter a very Canadian thing to build. But it's so tragic to see. We've done better at curbing it just because we have a more social cohesion and we have better healthcare and we have more responsible government.
The pandemic, as much as it's a pandemic, it's not just a pandemic, the withering, which is the kind of event you write about in Greenwood, that I read to me as sort of an extension of some of the things that happened in the Dust Bowl era. Is that right? Do you want to explain to the reader what the withering was, is?
Sure. The novel opens in the short-term future where something that is called the Great Withering that has taken place. And it is a sort of an unknown phenomenon, but it's essentially many or most of the world's trees have withered and died due to climate change, essentially. But that has taken the form of drought, stress, fires, infestations of insects and molds and funguses and blights. And so trees in the world have become this very luxurious commodity, essentially, where only the wealthy are allowed to access them. Though this novel takes place, you know, in the past for the majority of its pages, only, you know, 50 pages of a 500-page book take place in the near future. many people have been calling it dystopian or sort of a science fiction type story, which I have trouble with, just in the sense that this great withering is really not that far-fetched. And, you know, I think one of the things the book points out is that trees and forests appear and, you know, so mighty and so powerful and so resilient. But in truth, they are actually very finely tuned to not only their climate zones, but also their microclimates and, you know, what they're next to and what the ground cover looks like and the precipitation and everything at coming at specific times is very important to the tree's long-term survival. And so this withering is very possible, and it's happening here on the island where I live, the Western red cedars, which are a tree that the indigenous people here have been using for thousands and thousands of years to make clothing with, to make, you know, boats, to make everything with. Those trees are withering and dying now due to drought stress. And so it's a man-made environmental disaster. And I think another point that the book makes is that that the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl in North America, which afflicted Canada worse than the United States, were one of the sort of first large scale climate disasters experienced in this part of the world anyway. And were due to the fact that we weren't caring for the soil, we weren't caring for the grasses of the prairie, and the dust flew in the air and the whole world, you know, went to shit. And so I draw a parallel, I think, between those events.
With the Dust Bowl, was there a particular series of storms? What kind of started, because I mean, I know about the soil swirling through the air, and that's been happening in Australia a bit too. It happened during the fire, around the time of the fires. Was it just over a period of years, or?
It was a period of years, and it was in conjunction with a new sort of farming, sort of industrialized farming equipment that was available. And it was also monoculture farming became popular. And it was also that they tried to farm in places like Oklahoma, where that soil is just not made. It can't support a crop like wheat year after year. And so they just essentially desertified large portions of the American plains. And they grew and grew and grew, and their farming practices continued to be bad. And so they had dust clouds in New York City at times it was a massive disaster, which I'm sure, I guess that must be different than how it happens there, obviously.
Well, what's been happening in summer is this actually happened during the fires, but there was sort of all the soil from Mildura, which is about 5 hours drive north of Melbourne, sort of blew into the city sometime in January. I don't think it was about the fires, it was just around the time of the fires. And so there was literally red rain and everything was covered in red soil, and events like that are happening quite often. It was back in the 80s, there was that amazing dust storm in Melbourne before the last really bad fires we had in the 80s were preceded by this massive kind of inland Australia kind of rolling around. So the desertification, I always mispronounce it, I start to think of that.
Me too, yeah.
But that's happening here. And my understanding is that I think a lot, certainly there's an eminent Australian biologist who's, he and his team are arguing that most of the large old trees will have died by the end of this century. And as you write, we'll be left without trees because they're not being replaced. It's not just that old trees are dying, it's that it's harder and harder for new trees to establish themselves. I'm not going to keep going down that track, or I'll just end up, you know, in tears on that, which is not what we want. I'm working on a project at the moment, and one of my colleagues said, we've been discussing it, we really want to know, is there much, are people writing hopefully in this collection that I'm working on? And I went, and I started trying to think of all the work that was being produced, and it was a little bit of a struggle, even though there are some good things happening, and I do think it's good that we're actually acknowledging what's happening, which is why the point you made about your work not being dystopian or future, being set in the future anyway, is really important. And you actually, this is just more a kind of observation, the other thing that's happening at the same time as the withering is there's a kind of a virulent form of TB, is that right? Also afflicting people, which is why their lungs are kind of fairly wretched, which is just like a little kind of note.
Yeah, and this is something that actually did happen during the Impression. There were kids who would get this, what is essentially black lung you see in coal miners. Kids were getting that, and the elderly and people were dying due just to the dust. The fine dust everywhere was enough to kill many people. So it's, yeah, that didn't take any imagination either, so tragically.
One of the other things that I really responded to in your novel, other than tree love, was I come from a non-traditional family. I mean, most people in the world do, frankly, but I really loved how you kind of interrogate, makes it sound like this sort of polemical thing, and it's not at all. It just emerges in the book that what is the nature of biological relationships versus other kinds of relationships is really, I found, really grew quite powerfully for me, that people try and imagine what a family might be, and they often follow the wrong leads because they're thinking just in terms of biology. Do you want to talk a little bit about how conscious that was, that kind of consideration of what makes a family and what makes relationships?
Well, I'm very happy to hear that resonated with you. It's a big part of the book, and it's something that I ended up being maybe most proud of, or proud of anyway, because when you set out to write a multi-generational family saga, you run into this problem, and that is families generally are sort of these paternalistic, patriarchal structures that, and a person's blood, quantum becomes an issue, and it just raised all these sort of difficult questions for me. And so I was really happy to try to subvert that idea that a family is a known thing that reaches down through history, and there are these people with one name, and they carry their lineage forward, which is this old sort of and frankly ridiculous idea that probably has never been true. And so there are adoptions, there are deceptions, there are
babies left in the woods.
Yeah, there are babies left in the woods. There are all kinds of curveballs that are thrown into the family lineage, which I really love. And actually, I haven't really talked about this much, but my great-grandfather was himself a foundling. He was left on the doorstep of a Christie in the town where I grew up, Thunder Bay in Ontario, and was taken in by this family. And then my aunt did some research, and she found that his mother's name was Euphemia Baxter, which is one of the characters in the novel.
Yeah, great name.
So that's my great great grandmother's name, and she was a domestic worker in Scotland. She did not have any money. She came to Canada, apparently got pregnant, and and did what she did. And so now I'm a Christie, and it makes absolutely no sense that this name is attached to me, but yet I do feel like a Christie. And so I just find it very interesting. And I think it's fiction's job to complicate these notions that we have, and to sort of make them, to show just how complex a thing that a family truly is, and I see it with my friends and people in my community who've adopted, or people who have blended families, or people who have done any number of non-traditional methods of building a family. And I think it was important to me to honor the depth of the love that can develop between people who are not biologically related to each other. And that was an important thing to me.
And you also do it with romantic relationships as well, in that there are a couple of, I'm thinking of a couple of the really significant relationships in the book, but they're not about sex. I mean, sex occurs, and it's about these sort of long, really long-term relationships which are dormant for years and then reemerge that never leave a person necessarily. I'm thinking both of Harris's relationship and his brother Evett's relationships, and that's really quite moving the way particular people kind of, that actually makes me think of trees, the idea of two trees growing together, even if they're not always communicating. I really loved how you talked about relationship more generally, not just in terms of that kind of family as well.
Yeah,
and like great loves. They're romantic. It's quite romantic, I find.
Yeah,
those two relationships I'm referring to, I found was removed by.
Yeah, and I think, you know, obviously as a literary fiction writer, you know, you don't want to get into, you know, romance novel territory, but I think there's a lot of room for us to write about love as it is found on earth. And I've seen people who are in love, and I am in love, and I know, and I think that it's a fiction writer's duty to try to create a credible depiction of love. And yeah, so those relationships, I mean, it's fun to write a book that spans so much time, because you're really free to show how a relationship can evolve over time. And you know, the reader gets more invested, I think, because of those sort of, as the years pass. But that was great fun. And those are all, you know, both of those relationships you're talking about, both for Everett and for Harris, are non-traditional for their time relationships.
Yeah.
And they were rewarding to write.
Yeah. Actually, I was thinking of Everett's relationship. It's Temple, isn't it? The woman he's involved with.
Yeah.
There's an amazing scene which is about her, not about the other characters, in which she's caught in a she loses her library. She has a library of books. And the books get spun up into, is it a tornado? Can you talk a little bit about that scene? It's an extraordinarily vivid scene. I sort of wondered where it came from.
Yeah, so it's
beautiful.
Temple.
Scene.
Temple is a woman who sort of comes from a farming lineage. She lives in a place called, or outside of a place called Estevan, Saskatchewan, which is in southern Saskatchewan, which is the part of Canada, the flattest, most prairie-like province, and she's a wheat farmer, but she also runs a kind of an informal halfway house for tramps and out of work people to come and do some work and eat. And so, as a part of that, she has a library as well, where you're allowed. The rule is you're allowed to take a book if you leave a book, and it's sort of an informal library for people who are passing through. And so over time, she amasses, you know, thousands of books in this sort of ersatz little building. But at one point during the narrative, cyclone or a tornado hits her town and draws all of the books from the library up into the air. And that scene came. I actually traveled to Estevan, Saskatchewan, and did some research, and there were weather events that were similar that, you know, would suck the roof off a house. There was one that hit a small movie theater, and I remember hearing accounts or reading accounts of different parts of the movie theater being, you know, thrown into the air and scattered for miles. So though it pained me being a book lover to do this to Temple's library, it was such a striking image to me, and was worked in the story, and yeah, so I made it up.
It becomes quite a fabulous part of the plot though as well.
It does, but, yeah, we had to use it.
Just because we don't have much more time, but I just thought finally we'd come to Jake, who's the, when I say the main character, I mean the character from 2038, so she's both the beginning and the end of the book, and she's the one that's dealing with the withering And she, you don't believe in heroes. You have lots of anti-heroes. And I don't mean by that that they necessarily behave badly, but they neither behave well nor badly, depending on what is required of them. And Jake, you really resist any traditional kind of ending for her. That is, she doesn't, you know, she, I was really struck by her. She's such a wonderful character. And I have been thinking a lot about what it's like for young people at the moment, like being in your 20s and 30s and dealing with the collapse of the education system, how do you find a job, all these kind of things which are happening now, not just in the future. And she's developing her kind of survival skills at the same time as trying to care for trees. I really, really loved her. Can you talk a little bit about her and indeed her name? All your names are great. I mean, the names and the character in the novel are great. And I really struggle with names. So any advice on how to pick good names would also be welcome.
So Jake Greenwood is her real name is Jacinda Greenwood. And she is a mixed race person. She grew up in, after her mother's death, she grew up in India, and made her way back, to North America, where her father was from, and became kind of a leading researcher on the, intercommunicative, properties of Douglas fir. Research that's actually been done at UBC, and so Jake has an enormous amount of student debt. She has a very, very specialized education and an expensive education, and things seem to be going well. And then the Great Withering strikes, and Jake is reduced to working at a resort for wealthy people to come and sort of walk through the last remaining old growth forest, or one of them in the world. And she's just essentially a tour guide leading people through the trees and giving them sort of little facts about the forest. And so I do some mentorships, in writing mentorships of, you know, younger writers. And it's fascinating to speak with millennials in particularly about their view of the future, and their view of education, I think, is very different than maybe the view that I grew up with, that if you're, you know, you get a university degree, you get a graduate degree, you're going to find some work, you know, things are going to be okay for you. You're going to live in a livable situation, where all of that, I think, is up in the air now for millennials in particular. And they are they're living a very uncertain existence. And that gives me a lot of grief, having sons myself. And so I tried to sort of extrapolate forward for Jake, and to sort of see into the near future and imagine most jobs becoming, you know, service jobs in the sort of the decline of the middle class and all of that stuff. So that Jake was my version of that.
There is a lot more that I could ask, but I think we're coming close to the end of time. I know that the last time we spoke, I think I put you on the spot and I said, do you have anything you would like to say to the audience? And I hadn't warned you that I would do that, but I'm going to do it again anyway. I suppose what I'm interested in is what it must be like for you, building this connection as your book travels around the world. You are building connections with people in Australia and I assume in other countries. It must be quite a strange experience, kind of experiencing other countries through the prism both of promoting your book and through the year we're having and through having travelled a lot. So any observations or any comments you had would be welcome.
That's fine. I like to be on the spot. You can put me on the spot anytime, Sophie. It's okay. I think two things. One, I've been startled and encouraged by just, you know, the novel has sold in many different countries. And I've been sort of astonished. It's like, I know Canadians care about trees and are interested in this stuff, but the degree to which people, like I just signed a contract for a publisher in Taiwan to publish it in complex Chinese, Greenwood. And so just the resonance and Germany and, you know, France and all, just all over the place. And so just the resonance that a book about a family and about who are intimately tied with trees, the resonance that that has had around the world with all kinds of people has been really encouraging, because I think, you know, trees are almost a stand-in for nature a lot of the time. They're sort of the purest form of nature. They're the most perfect aspect of nature in some ways, and the most human aspect of nature. And so if you can take that as any kind of indication that people care about the natural world and they want to read about it and they want to know more, and that is encouraging. And the last thing, part of the message of the book is the fact that during difficult times, now I'm going to get schmarmy here, but during difficult times, people have drawn together and have behaved collectively and have, cared for one another and been kind to one another, like in the Depression. And I think right now we see the countries who are doing that and we see the countries who aren't doing that. And it's been a real wake-up call, I think, to everyone, the fact that, you know, we must work collectively and we must take care of one another going forward after this pandemic is over, hopefully it will be over someday, into the climate crisis. That's the only thing that's going to keep us safe and keep our lives livable. So we need to do it.
That's beautiful, Michael. Thank you. I'm going to leave us there. And I hope that next time we talk, it might actually be in person. That would be good.
I would love that. I would love that.
Okay. Well, thanks
okay.
For
thank
us.
You so much, Sophie. That was really fun.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this conversation. For more podcasts, sign up to our e-news at mwf.com.au.